right. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome back to Gravel Kings. I am a professional cyclist and sometimes a very amateur, low-level, not anywhere close to professional videographer, Ted King.
I am semi-professional gravel cyclist, Laura King, and also childcare logistics extraordinaire.
Yeah, you are. I am Stu Streeter, age group cyclist, and one time all night bicycle rider.
Woo.
It's in the books. It's been done.
One time. Meaning it has been done one time. Does that mean you're one and done and you're not going to do it again? Or are you inspired to do more?
No, it's a good question. I will absolutely do more.
Uh-huh.
It was a hoot.
Yeah.
In almost every way.
Yeah.
So I may be pushing my luck, but more on that later. Laura, logistics, I've watched you, even over the last few minutes with your children, they're amazing, by the way.
Thanks.
Logistics, coordinations, talk about that.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's challenging when we're home just because we do have like fluid, ever-changing schedules. We try to, though, stick to some semblance of a schedule, but once we're on the road, things are moving. There's so many moving parts and things are crazy. So for example, yesterday I was on a climb and we're helping to lead a Velocio ride next Sunday. And I got a message from a friend at Velocio who texted me back and said, you know, the ride's on Monday, right? And suddenly I go into panic mode in my mind because I've been, Ted's looking at me terrified.
What?
Don't worry. It's actually on Sunday, but
okay.
In my mind, I'm suddenly going through all the ramifications of this mistake that I somehow
newfound information.
Yes. And I'm thinking, okay, I had the childcare set up. I invited friends. I have this, I have that. We had a whole kind of, we're going down to San Francisco. We'll try to intersect with friends at that same time. So panic averted because there are multiple rides happening and it was a miscommunication. It's happening on Sunday, but those are the types of things that I'm constantly replaying in my head. Like, okay, what time are we going? Where, which town are we going to be in? and yeah, it's a bit of a puzzle, but we're in Sonoma County where we spent so much time. So thankfully we have a friend and trusted sitter here who has been kind enough to kind of just jump on our schedule and has flexibility when we're here, and friends who are helping out, and so far so good. So that's just requires a lot of planning and forethought, and a lot of it is like talking to Ted saying, okay, what do you think your training schedule is going to be this day? And how many hours do you need? And what do I need? And should we just switch off or should we plan for care that day? And so it's thinking a lot into the future about where we don't always know actually what exactly we're going to need. But so far it seems to have worked out.
Legit.
And during all these logistics that have been happening, I've seen you, Ted, sitting around editing video.
As you do. I have just recently wrapped up a pre-Levi's Grand Fondo growler episode, which is the keynote reason why we're here. We, dear listener, are sitting in the same room, all three of us, which is the first time that we've done it. This is live. This is very exciting.
It really is fun.
And we're here because of Levi's Grand Fondo, which is a long-standing event. It's been going on for at least 10 years. I want to say maybe a little bit longer. I've participated in two or three over the years, so I'm familiar with it. But then this year in particular, they've undergone something of a transformation in that they have a very keynote race called the Growler. We talked about it real briefly last episode, at which point we pointed out that I did not know even what the route was, but we've gone on to do a little bit of reconnaissance. It is, in fact, 138 miles. There are, in fact, over 13,000 feet of climbing, and if you want to learn a thing or two about it, you can check out my video.
I'd say one thing to note, the men and women's elite race is actually taking place kind of on its own, whereas most gravel events are, you know, full mass start. So, and the rules are actually that if you are in the elite wave, you cannot work with an amateur. If I don't know the time really? Difference, but if they catch up to you, you are not allowed to work with them. You'll be disqualified. So that's a change from gravel.
And do the men and women start together and you guys roll out together, or are there different waves for men and women?
They do. They roll out together.
Wow.
Yeah, so that'll be an interesting dynamic.
4 p.m. tomorrow. Pay attention to the mandatory pre-race meeting.
That's right.
And we'll figure it all out. Yeah, I mean, what we were talking about right now is really interesting because it's such a, you know, we're at an interesting time in cycling, in domestic road racing in North America especially. This is 100% a paved event. The pavement is so beat up that there are plenty of times that, you know, you can be on smooth gravel and it's 100 times simpler and easier. But these are really antiquated farm roads. They have a lot of history. They have a lot of decades of life, and they have a lot of potholes in places that have been beat up. And so, yeah, it's like this long-standing event. It is entirely paved. And then it's at this crossroads of the popularity of gravel. So the question is this event a road race or a gravel race?
Yeah, I was just reading Pete Stetna's post about it, and he was kind of saying this is, he thinks it's essentially going to play out like a gravel race on road because, you know, team cars are not allowed. There are not, essentially everyone coming is a privateer racing for themselves. It's self-supported. I don't believe you can have, there's neutral aid stations, but you aren't allowed support outside of yourself or maybe a team member. I'm not sure. I mean, maybe a fellow racer.
There are teams. There are teams on, and like that's the really interesting dynamic. It is not 100% privateers. So, and by privateers, I mean someone who's looking after themselves. Keegan and Tobin are a team. There are four members of Project Echelon, which is North America's best domestic road team.
Okay, no different than gravel, since they
correct.
They do.
But Mike's Bikes, I'm sure, is going to field the team.
Yep.
They don't necessarily field teams at the gravel events, and they've got some hitters.
Yep.
And I assume there's others too, regional teams.
So yeah. You know, it's interesting. I don't think that is the case within the women's field.
Oh, really?
Maybe I need to find a teammate.
That's a great question.
I'm very familiar with every woman racing, and I don't think there are any formal associations happening.
That's what tomorrow's for.
Yeah, exactly.
Everybody build alliances.
Right. Yeah, exactly. You know, it's interesting this course though, because every time I think about how that works with a teammate, I mean, these long, steep climbs, as soon as we get to the base of, I imagine we'll stay in groups until we get to the base of King Ridge, the first, 6 mile climb that's upwards of, I don't know, the steepest sections.
25% according to my Garmin.
It's brutal, and I think it is going to, from previous experience racing up King Ridge, I think it's going to splinter the field in a big way. And I think the crux for the women's field, especially being rather small, is if it splinters such that you are kind of left alone, that is a really long day to ride the rest of the course by yourself.
Let me interject real quick. For our fair listener who does not know the course, which you are forgiven if you don't, because up until about 4 days ago, I didn't know the course. 138 miles. It begins with approximately 20-ish mile, perfectly flat section along a river. You go into the Bohemian woods and end up in the town of Casadero, and then you hit the first climb that Laura's talking about. The course is punctuated by three big climbs. They're sort of smack in the middle. The first is called King Ridge, and then a pretty big descent. The second, you go flat a long ways and then hit the biggest climb of the day. That's called Skaggs, which is, I want to say it's a very consistent, like 6 or 7 miles, just consistent 6-7%. It is a beast. And that drops you down towards the town of Cloverdale. And then from Cloverdale, you're sneaking your way around, up a climb called Geysers, and then descend that and head back to the start village of Windsor.
Now, we have ridden here hundreds of times. We know these roads, I think, like the back of our hands. Like
yeah.
Every turn, every kind of distinction that needs to be, you know, attention paid. However, I don't think there's ever been a time where we thought, let's ride King Ridge, Skaggs, and Geysers All in one day.
Mega hopper. Oh. I mean, literally, that's what this is. This is a mini mega hopper. So like, the grasshoppers.
Right. Who would do such a thing?
The grasshoppers are these races begun by Miguel Crawford, and he started this underground race series that has been going on for 25, 26 years now. And each one of those climbs that we've just said would be its own course. Like Skaggs is its own course, or Old Kaz is its own course, blah, blah, blah. Geysers is its own course. So yeah, I think you're right. We've raced each one of these individually. Mm-hmm. I linked them together in this, crazy 500-mile mega hopper, which included many more. So this is a mini mega hopper in that it's three events in one.
You know, if they would have just added Sweetwater in, we could be at a cool 15,000 feet of climbing on the day.
Easy.
It's just insane. And for our listeners, for like the mere mortal, like I'm doing the geysers route, which is 88 miles, which is
a monstrous day.
Yeah. For any of us mere mortals. And so to your point, Ted, like you guys will climb geysers and it will be like the third and final and easiest climb of your day. For us, it's like a monster. So the thought of doing two other climbs, I mean, speaking of like the transformation of cycling in North America, mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, road scene aside, the rides have just gotten so big.
Yeah, the arms race to one-upsmanship, who can make the bigger course, harder course.
Like, I just looked at that route when you guys were like, hey, come out and do Levi's. And I'm like, yeah. Hard no on that. And then the next one, nope, not doing that either. Okay, 88 miles, so that's a long
race. Have you looked at the profile?
Yeah.
I mean, your race is effectively, I'm not looking at the distance in front of me, so I'm making this up. It's sort of this long, gradual, false flat, just forever getting steeper, steeper, steeper. You're basically doing like a 50-mile climb.
Yeah.
And then it's a screaming descent and a nice coast back to town.
Yeah.
Is that exactly. Right? So what's your psyche? Are you thinking of it as a 50-mile race or... How are you breaking the event down?
Well, I'm a terrible climber, and I am, you know, truth be told, mostly here to hang out with you guys. So I have no aspirations on Saturday other than to suffer in the rain and then finish the day, and it'll be great training and really fun. So my aspirations are, A, stay warm, B, don't crash on the descent, mm-hmm. and then C, hear how you guys did when you each got your top 10s. That's it.
Lower expectations, please.
Top 20s.
It is a ridiculous lineup.
Yeah, it is.
So, yeah, I don't know where our aspirations lie. I think Laura mentioned that, yeah, we know the course very well. I think that is a huge advantage. So, you know, like where sort of false summits exist on the climbs. Knowing the corners is very important for the descents. Knowing the type of terrain and just how bad the terra firma is. And you mentioned the weather there. We're here. Laura's been in California for, a week? I think we'll talk about this briefly, but you've been here about a week. In fact, a week to the day. The weather's been spectacular. And California's had a very wet winter and early spring, as Stu can attest as the local. But right now, it is, 80 degrees and cloudless.
It's almost unbelievable. I was saying to Stu, like, once you get near the coast, maybe it's because we spent a lot of time here more early spring last year, but this seems like a rarity where it feels like 80 degrees, you know, not far from the coast, and we're amidst all the redwoods, and it's still sleeveless Jersey weather in the trees, which is a real treat. But it's really hard to believe there's going to be this storm coming on Saturday.
Yeah, truth be told, the timing couldn't be worse, because the race begins fairly early on Saturday morning, and if you look at a weather forecast, it turns out the rain hits Friday night, early Saturday.
Yeah, it just keeps getting worse.
Yeah.
That's fine by Sunday.
Right, exactly. Yeah, Sunday should be great.
Just one day could have made all the difference.
And then talking to some good local friends, like Jeff Junkson is down in Mill Valley, and he hosts Dawn Patrol. He's been talking about reliably Saturday mornings have been wet. And so it's funny how... not funny, haha, but the irony of you sort of grit through or make it through a work week and the weather's nice, and on the weekends the weather turns foul.
Yeah. I've been exchanging some messages with fellow female competitors, and it's nice to know everyone is, what's the word?
Got some angst.
Yeah, exactly. Has some angst about the weather and how that increases the risk. And, you know, that makes me feel better because it, we're all, well, I think the majority of us, our aim is to finish healthy first and foremost. And I was just talking to Ted about this the other night, just saying like, I enjoy doing these events, but yeah, first and foremost, like Ted's about to take off after Sea Otter to Europe. And the last thing that needs to happen is like, and land in the hospital or it somehow, you know, my mobility is inhibited and now I need support. That would really throw a wrench in a lot of things. So, just thinking about this course probably is one of the, I don't know, most harrowing in wet weather because of the nature of the like steep switchbacks and steep twisting descents and cattle guards. So I think it's going to be number one, just risk averse. And I, that's become my number one goal. So,
well, and I didn't know what to make of that. I was asking Ted earlier offline and I don't know how best to say it, Laura, but I was comforted to know that you were feeling that too. Because as, you know, just an age grouper, I would almost not do an event if it was going to be rainy, especially on a gravel event, if it's going to be super muddy.
Totally.
Purely for just the pure expense of what it will cost me to do that day. Knowing, okay, if I do 100 miles in the mud, I know that's a $500 bill at the end because I'm going to have to replace the drivetrain on it, you know. And so, that, I mean, I know bike mechanics love to hear me say this and race promoters hate to hear me say this, but guys like me will say, man, I would have loved to have done the race, but I'm going to transfer my reg to next year. That's a little different on a road race, but I was comforted to hear that you felt anxiety too because I looked at the weather.
Well, yeah, I guess with the statement that I always feel pre-raced angst, we've talked about this a little bit on the podcast before, but the week before a race, I pretty much decide that I actually hate racing and have severe regret for why I decided to sign up for this event.
Verbatim last night.
Yeah. And I was saying, I just have to keep talking through it because I'm like, I know myself, this happens every time and I always have a great time and it's generally fine. And I wake up the next day and I'm elated that I did it. Cause Ted said, just don't do it. You know, I'm going through my angst and worries and I'm like, not doing the race would not solve the problem. Well, then I would just be upset at myself for not doing the race. It's like a lose-lose situation. So really it's just, I know myself, I've gone through this kind of cycle enough to know it's my own nerves that create this feeling of dread and a little bit of like, oh, this is going to hurt. I don't know if I want to hurt this bad, but I know I'm, you know, it's like you're marching into battle.
Help the rest of us. What's the self-talk?
You know,
not a bad weather,
having kids helps me a lot because it's a distraction from myself. It's a distraction from sitting in my own kind of, in my mind of just, thinking about, you know, marinating on all the worries and anxiety. So I love having the distraction of like taking care of my kids and seeing the world through their eyes that they don't really, knowing that they don't care what happens at the end of the day. And also reminding myself that the person that cares the most about my performance is me. It's no one else. No one cares, really. And it's me putting my own expectations on myself. And for what? Like, what is the worst case scenario? I don't perform well to my ability. And, you know, I'll have a day where I feel bummed about it and life will move on. And there will be another bike race and another bike race and another bike race. So, or I can choose to not participate in a bike race. Should I, you know, I've signed up for this on my own. So, I think those are the things I try to focus on. And maybe you don't have kids, but it's just a, whatever it might be, like, you know, I had work calls this morning. It's just nice to do life and keep focused on things other than bike racing, because at the end of the day, like, bike racing is supposed to be this fun thing that we do that gives us joy and not that fills our life with angst. And, you know, The only thing I would say is I did not have, I think my level of angst has just risen because of the potential ramifications of, you know, just something happening to me and, just having a family and what that means for having a family. And, I guess just not wanting, just hoping that I'll be healthy and able-bodied post race. And so, yeah, the beginning of the rollout, it makes me nervous, in wet conditions. I feel confident about my own skills, but, you know, I've been watching, if you've been watching bike racing at all, and I said this to Ted the other day, you just see these massive pileups and crashes and it gets in your head. Yeah. You're like, well, they're the most skilled cyclists in the world. So if they're crashing, I mean, the odds are high. There's going to be some sort of one race where we have some sort of pileup like that. And, you know, so yeah, the risks do exist. We don't, I mean, this is a dangerous sport, and just, I guess I can only control the controllables, and I have a couple pro roadie friends who have been giving me advice about just like navigating my way in the peloton at the beginning and trying to give me some tips.
So how is that for you guys as a couple on an event like that, where you're starting, you're doing the same course, mm-hmm. and you're rolling out together? Like, do you guys talk about how that will roll? Like, Ted, do you like, I need to be left alone and I got to go into my own headspace and do my thing. Peace out. See you at the end of the day. Will you ride together? So, you know, how does that play out for you? Do you guys talk that through?
It's not scripted. We don't plan it. I would say I casually as possible, roll up to the start line relatively last minute. And Laura is probably somewhere nearby. And then we're conveniently towards the front. And it's great. I mean, I recognize that that's a privilege, because there are plenty of people who have been lined up for 20 minutes, or in the case of Mid-South, an hour beforehand to get their position in the start corral. Gotcha. So I recognize that privileged position. And then the start gun goes off and we roll out, and I'm aware of where Laura is for what, a minute, 3 minutes. I mean, you do a very good job of sticking to my wheel, but at that point, we're in different races, effectively. I mean, I try to keep my head on a swivel and be aware of where she is. And I have great trust in her ability. And yeah, I mean, it is a inherently dangerous sport, right? We're not talking about professional... Is it snooker? Is that darts? Like, do you think... You know, they probably have a different level of angst, but they're not worried about getting shot in the arm with an errant dart. Like, right. this is a dangerous sport. And I think, yeah, we have a different perspective as a lot of our competitors, in that they're not parents and they're not, you can sort of race hellbent for leather. And we have, I guess, a different algorithm.
Especially given your last 2 years of misfortune. You know, it's like, we don't need, it's like, you have the feeling that, like, we don't need another injury or... setback. But I think once, to answer your questions too, once the race is going, I think about Ted's race and him a lot during the race. Okay. I think
that's what I meant to say about Laura.
Well, I think a bit of it is it's nice to, once you're out. So once I'm past the first, you know, the hectic part of the beginning of the race, and kind of have found my place, and I'm just doing what I'm supposed to do, which is ride a bike, I'm able to take a deep breath and feel like, okay, now I'm just riding my bike, and I feel calm, and I feel happy, and I feel privileged to be out there. And then I also think, I wonder how Ted's doing. You know, I'll say a prayer for him. Keep him safe. Please keep him upright. I hope he's feeling strong today. And it's nice to think about, I don't know, it's nice to think about something other than yourself. There have been times where, let's like thinking back to Steamboat, this was one moment that sticks out in my mind. I was pregnant and riding with my friend. We did the full 140 course, but not racing it by any means. So, was quite...
You won first place in the pregnant category.
I was quite a ways back when I got a text.
Solo break?
Yes.
I don't remember. I think I got a text, or I... No, maybe I... I can't remember if I saw you, but anyway, you were doing really well. And then I got the text that you won, and never have I been more motivated to like get to the finish line so I could celebrate with you. So that was one moment that really stuck in my mind.
That's cool. That was neat.
But yeah, you know, it's nice to have the perspective of, okay, if you don't have the day you want, you hope your partner has the day they want, and vice versa. You have, so that you have one win for the team for the day.
the King family had a win. Yeah.
So, yeah, back to you, Stu. What do you force, like, do you have angst before events? Do you have angst for this in particular because there is inclement weather? How do you feel about the course? And
I don't look forward to the bad weather, but I don't have angst about it. And I am low on the talent pool and low
on the BMXer. You have great talent.
Well, talent in terms of, you know, there's a big climb coming and it's really hard to hide on a climb, right?
And so, but you have great bike dexterity. Like, you're not worried about the
no, in fact, for me, like, the worse the weather, the better for a bike race for me.
Okay.
Because I can hide a little bit better in the bad weather, and I kind of hope that it gets strung out early and the good climbers have to burn a match or two. And partly, like, I'd like it to be single file because it just feels safer. Mm-hmm. If it's single file and strung out, I just hide. I find the biggest guy I can and hide behind him. So I don't feel that sort of angst. And I'll be so far off the back on the descent anyway that by that point, my day will be done, you know, and I'll be so happy that I got over the climb. So I don't feel that angst. I just feel gosh, I took a weekend off and I booked a hotel and I drove over and, you know, I can suffer in the rain on my own at home. So there's that.
Yeah.
And that's why I asked the question of the self-talk. Like, that's not a good headspace to go into. So it's self-talking your way out of that and thinking, you know, how lucky am I in that I get to, you know, we talked about this on our bike ride today of you're looking around and here's two guys in their 40s in the middle of the day when I'm not trying to overplay it, but there's like literally people hungry and people digging ditches right now. And we're on nice bicycles out riding, stopping for muffins. So it's like, okay.
Exactly.
Yeah. Things are going pretty good for us. Yeah. Right. Yeah. You know, life has gone pretty well. So if it's a little rainy on Saturday, everything is going really well still.
Let's just also point out, though, that rainy days in Northern California are some of the coldest I've ever spent on a bike.
Yeah.
Marine air combined with the moisture is just, it can be like biting cold. I think particularly because you descend for so long. So if you're comfortable on the climb, we're going to be going hard enough, but you get soaking wet and then you're just descending. I mean, and there are not a lot of points on course. You know, it's not like you can just get a pickup or something. When you get on the backside of Skaggs, you're in the middle of nowhere. There's no cell service.
Right.
There's hardly a car.
But let that be a good piece of local know-how. Like, you know that you are going to save some energy by being well-dressed. There are a lot of people who are going to look at it and be like, oh, 52 degrees and rainy? Pfft. Let me go short sleeves.
Yeah, for real. Because we'll be riding hard, so I'll be warm. Yeah. Like, good luck with that.
Exactly. And it's not as though you have a nice, clean, smooth, easy descent to sit up and zip your vest on, right? Mm-hmm. It's like some of the most harrowing, twisty descents that you're ever going to see. So,
yeah, I actually haven't nailed down what I'm going to wear. I'm thinking, like, how am I going to access the food in my pockets? My rain jacket doesn't have, you know, you got to unzip it to get access to the pockets. And
I'm getting excited as we're talking about it, actually. I'm, like, starting to look forward to it. Like, all right, let's just suffer in the rain. Let's do it.
It's going to be great. It's going to be great.
So let's talk about the orchestration with which it took to get here, because it's not as though we're here for one road race. On this trip, Laura and I have 5 bicycles with which to juggle.
Listeners need to buckle up right now.
I think 6 with Hazel's.
Unbelievable.
6 with Hazel's. Well said. 5 bikes. So let's count them. Laura and I each have a road bike for this event. Next weekend, or the weekend following, is Sea Otter. We will race the Fuego XL, I think they're calling it these days, which is, what, a nearly 70-mile mountain bike race. That's 2 more. And then I go from there to Portugal to do a three-day road bike trip, and then to the Traco, which is a gravel event. I'm not bringing two bikes to Europe because that'd be foolish, so I'm going to put Slicks on my gravel bike. But therefore, we have these five bikes plus Hazel's sixth bike. Now, the logistics were such that I mentioned Laura came out a couple days early, hung out with her. Why don't you tell us?
Well, first you had a whiteboard and put it in the house.
Amazon.
And I said, what is that for? And he has a divided line down the whiteboard, and he starts writing where bikes are going and what bikes need work. And he notes Laura road bike to California, Laura mountain bike to California. And I said, oh, contraire, I have good news for you.
Yeah, really good news. Really, really good news. But before, dear listener, you think that I'm a total nerd to go buy that piece of hardware in order to orchestrate this trip. Our basement is our bike room, and it's also our in-house gym. And we have such a extensive fleet of bikes to maintain, and I'm not saying that in a braggadocious way. Like, there are always bikes that need some sort of mechanical work. Like, oh yeah.
Especially Laura's, because I don't do the maintenance.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, why are my rotors squealing? Because you don't have pads, and you haven't had pads for 3 weeks. So it's to orchestrate that. Be like, okay,
I'm going to leave a bike here for you.
Yeah. Exactly. Add another column, right? Stu's bike needs new drivetrain. So that's why I got the whiteboard, and I'm happy about that. That's going to live in the basement. But then it also has orchestrated what bike's going where. And then to Laura's point, two of the, I'll call it 5.5 bikes that we need for this trip were already in California.
Keep my road bike and hardtail mountain bike. Well, I have, keep.
Exactly. In the anti-braggadocious way, we just happen to be lucky enough to have a spare bike or two.
Yes. And this is my older version of my road bike. So it's, you know, might my newer one be a little bit, I don't know, in better condition to be my race bike? Yeah, maybe, but
they still weigh less than Hazel's bike.
The bike in California is great. We come out here frequently enough that I have decided that my Black Beauty Super 6 Evo Cannondale likes the San Francisco air. So she lives out here, as does my hardtail. Now, my hardtail, actually, after racing the XL Fuego last year, I would prefer to do it on a race
full
suspension. But here's an example of where it's just like, you know what? We're going to make life, let's like take away a barrier here. And if I can just get through the race again on my hardtail, which it's, you know, there's disadvantages and advantages to the hardtail. It climbs a little bit better. It doesn't quite do some of the technical aspects as well.
Doesn't need a bike box.
But we can just deal with it, and yes, that's what we're doing. So I also have a dear friend who stores the bike, and our dear friend Anthony, who dropped it off at the bike shop, had it all tuned, and I just arrived, and it was ready to go.
Amazing.
That's
right.
A game changer.
So you're welcome, husband.
That's big.
So that was awesome. We still needed to get here. So Laura had her gals weekend, which largely went off without a hitch, minus the blizzard in which you had to fly out of.
That's right.
But in so many words, you got out and flew whilst nursing a little bit of a flu.
Oh, yeah, it was one of those cross-country travel days that you really hope you won't have to go through. And I had to switch planes in DC, and I was texting Ted that I was like, I can't make a cross country 6-hour flight right now. Like, I thought I was going to be like in the bathroom sick the whole time. And I went to the United desk ready to just say, hey, how do I change my flight? I need to get a hotel, and I'm really ill. And Ted just said, just to remind you, like, I know it sounds terrible, but if you just get yourself to California, then you're going to feel a whole lot better tomorrow morning knowing you don't have to fly across the country and you can like recover when you get there. And
yeah,
it sounded terrible to me. But I heeded his advice and just got myself on the plane. And
it's the old, we can do hard things.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially we can do hard things when you're flying alone. Like,
yeah, right.
That's simple. And I mean, yeah, I was thinking of the logistics of, okay, you're going to go to the United desk and tell them, hey, I need to get on a flight tomorrow. And then they're going to say, okay, we need to take your bags off this plane because you're probably a terrorist. And then you'll have to take these bags and
Exactly.
Drag it. You have a bike with you. You're going to drag it.
I went through all of this and the pros and cons. But, you know, as luck would have it, the United Desk was too busy to help me and just flashed a QR code in my face and said, just scan this and somebody will help you. And I said, no, they won't. I've tried that route before.
Oh, man.
You know what? The face-to-face customer service could really be improved. But anyway.
You should make a QR code that looks like a face.
Tangent.
And then you'd be like, oh, it's a face. So, Laura had a great trip, and she wined and dined with her friends, and she went out to dinner every single night. And
I didn't see pictures uptown. Did I just miss them?
Oh, because
I'm still living with so much FOMO that I've never climbed Mount Tam.
So, we climbed Mount Tam, but we did not do a dawn patrol, and the reason for that was our flight was canceled due to the snowstorm, so I got in at like 10 p.m. and was sick as a dog and thought, I am definitely not doing a 5 a.m. wake up or 4 a.m. wake up tomorrow morning to ride up the mountain. So, and it snowed that morning on the top of Tam. So despite the fact that we've just told you the weather was amazing, it was a bit chilly a couple days before arriving. There was once in a year snowflakes falling on the top of Mount Tamalpais.
Meanwhile, I took the kids from Vermont down to New Hampshire, visited my parents because it's my dad's 78th birthday. And then the large advantage of that was we could fly from Boston direct. Correction, nonstop. Do you know the difference between nonstop and direct?
I do not. And I fly every week.
Well, my mom will tell you. And she's told us. Back in the olden days, like if you were to fly Boston to, let's take San Francisco, for example, it would often be like you get on a plane and you fly from Boston, you land in Chicago, you sit there for a while. And then you take off again and fly to San Francisco.
That's a direct flight. Stuff.
That's a direct flight.
Oh, okay.
Nonstop means you take off in one place and land in the next place and get off the plane. So we had a nonstop flight, which, yeah, when you're flying with two kids, that's a bit of a chore, a solo. And, I mean, you know, my hat goes off to anyone who's flying with 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 kids. it wasn't the end of the world. And honestly, everything went remarkably smoothly. Mom dropped us off in Boston. We flew. Entertain the kids. Hazel melted her brain with 6 hours of television, and Hayden was a hoot and finally fell asleep after losing his mind for a long time.
She melted her brain.
She did proclaim, I got to watch, I don't know what she said.
She said
like,
6 hours.
Paw Patrol for the entire flight. I was like, well, hope you enjoyed it because not doing that again.
That was great. And I'm not kidding. It was a 6 hour flight. When we checked in, they said 6 hours and 42 minutes. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. You could fly to Central Europe from East Coast in that kind of time. And then they chopped a half hour flight off it. So it ended up being 6 hours. I realized it was a 42 minutes, not a half hour. Anyway, flew out. That was wonderful. We checked 6 items, including a bicycle. So, I mean, we're diving way into the details that people need not know. Get up here. Picked up Hazel's bike that has also been
in storage. No, I think you should tell the story of how you actually made it to.
It's amazing because I saw the photo, right? That you put on social media, and I think all of us were looking at that going, we don't know how you're going to get across the airport either.
SFO is a challenge because you have to get on the tram and to get all your bags on the tram you can't use the cart.
Smarty carties.
So it's physically impossible to get all of your stuff with your two kids. And I've encountered this before where like a dear friend met me at the airport, picked us up, took us to the rental car so that we could.
Well, I ain't got time for that. So I have my two kids. I go downstairs and I collect the baggage. And then whilst holding one child and Hazel squealing on the other side, I say to the kindly United agent, hi, I need to go to the car rental place. Are you familiar with where that is? Yes. And then I point at my stuff and I said, there's my 6 bags and bicycle. How do you think I can do this? And the first person says, whoa.
Yeah, right.
And she sort of goes behind the room and gets presumably a superior. And he comes back and literally says, you can't do that. And I said, I start laughing. I'm like, okay, well, what do you suggest I do? And he says, do you have another adult with you? And I say, no, that's a ridiculous question. So then a really nice United baggage handler who was certainly occupied doing something else went back, got a piece of paper, wrote down her phone number, and came back directly to me and said, you go get the car, and when you get to the front of the airport, you call me and I will have your bags there. And I said, you are a hero and doing the right thing. Thank you. That is, I mean, quite literally, that's the only thing that could happen. I said the only other option is I take my bags one by one, because I could carry one bag maybe. But I kid you not, listener, it's a 45-minute trip from the baggage, from baggage claim, up and around and on the train, and it's a super long train, to your car rental. So I'm like, you literally, it would take me 5 hours.
Yeah, the only other solution is getting an Uber XL, and you're going to rent a car seat, so you would only have one child in a car seat. And you wouldn't even bother. It would take too long to, like, install the car seat. So that's, like, that's the other kind of option that is out there, but it's super challenging, too.
So, all said and done, it was wonderful. And then I felt so bad. I said, I didn't have any cash. And I said, can I please cut you a check? And she said, no, just be safe. Have fun.
Wow. And Please United, call and sponsor the podcast. Yeah. Because this just sounded like
you should have gotten their name so you could write them a compliment. Right. I've done that before.
Yeah.
Had I think such she a was an angel. She literally customers. Disappeared. She just vanished in thin air.
I have sent compliments before. It's a nice thing to do because there's so many like negative experiences.
Yeah, you can do it in the app too. At least on Delta. Delta, please send money. Yeah. We have this little rivalry, listener, because the Kings are United Flyers and I'm a Delta guy.
It's not like we're in love with United. We just become beholden to one or the other.
Isn't it funny how that works, though? It's like you just become beholden and you have all these miles and status and you're like, I would never fly that airline. But not because there's anything wrong with it. It's just...
Oh, it's super handcuffs. Frustrating. Because on occasion, you type in the flight. You'd be like, Boston, San Francisco. Oh, look, Delta costs $300 less. But I'm not going to get any miles. I'm going to buy the expensive United flight.
Well, and I might not get, you know...
Right, and if I get delayed...
Yes.
If you get delayed, then you're stuck. Because you don't have status with them. So that's...
Exactly.
So, we made it. We made it up here. We're in Occidental, this amazing part of the country. It's an amazing place for our history. Not to bore the listener about the Ted and Laura show, but literally this is the town in which we met. It's the town in which we went on our first bike ride. It's the town, I think, where we fell in love.
And even
on our first date.
Even this house
that we're in.
You guys had some of your first hangouts here.
Yeah, we did.
Truth. After a grasshopper, we came back here and we literally ate a cheese dinner once. We thought there was going to be a big party. There had been a gathering of a handful of friends the night before the grasshopper, and then they all disappeared after the race. And we got to our friend's house here, and the only thing left was cheese. And we didn't have vehicles because the next day we were going to do a really long point-to-point ride. So we said, well, let's
light a candle,
drink some wine, and eat
like 7 blocks of different cheese and some little clementine oranges. And that was our dinner.
Only two people as fit as you could eat that for dinner and not be in a real bad way the next day.
Exactly. So.
And the romantic that I am, we watched Wedding Crashers that night. Which is also more of a testament to your patience, because that's like... The antithesis of what kind of a movie.
It was great. Date night, honey.
I pretended like I thought it was funny.
Here's what I got you.
I was just dying in hysterics watching it for the 38th time.
And she's going, who is this guy?
I'm like, you're into this movie too? No.
Our movie humor is a little different.
Yeah, you don't find movies funny.
No?
Name a comedy you like. Name a comedy. Not called Wedding Crashers.
I like romantic comedies.
Can you name one of those?
The Holiday.
Very good. That's not a comedy. Is it? Is that a rom-com?
Yeah, that's a rom-com. Yeah. Sure, it's a rom-com. Yeah. That's a good one.
But like, if you're not laughing, is it a comedy? Because it's not. That's not the kind of movie that you're like...
It's not funny.
Yeah, it's like... It's more like rom... Bad. Because it's like, it's a romantic bad movie. Whereas, at least a comedy, you're like laughing.
I was quoting Dumb and Dumber to Ted on a bike ride today because some guy on a scooter passed us with the biggest grin on his face. Yeah. And I thought, that, of course, that's how you have to look when you ride a scooter like that. And
it's 70 miles to the gallon on this hog.
Oh, that's great.
So, yeah, we sort of walked through where we're going from here. We have Sea Otter coming up, and then Portugal and Spain. Laura goes to Washington and Seattle, and then we'll reconvene. The craziest part to me is we have all of this extensive travel and logistics that go into planning and then into practice. But like in reality, I feel like you look at a calendar and we're home so soon. So it's amazing the number of places that we're going between now and then. And speaking of places that we've been and are going, Stu, you went a place or two.
I did.
Let's go back to the top of the show. You did a pretty sweet point-to-point ride.
I did. It was so fun. And
home to home. What was the name for?
It's really true. It was kind of home to home.
Yeah.
Well, I called it my fake FKT. Because...
FKT?
Yeah, because I have the fastest known time now on the route from Shingle Springs to Reading.
Well, yeah.
I have it.
I call it OKT. It's the only known time.
Well, yeah, that would be more accurate to call it the OKT, but then I couldn't call it an FKT. But it's really fake because nobody's ever done that before. Nobody would think to. Nobody would care to.
But wait, I think you got a little bit of a... Your friend made you...
My brother
commemorated.
Did.
Oh, your brother.
My older brother made that plaque for me out of copper. Listeners, you can go on my Instagram stories. I have a highlight story with all the stuff from the ride. And I did a little bit of a vlog diary along the way, which got a little delirious. I watched a few of them the next day and thankfully didn't say anything embarrassing, just nonsensical at 2 a.m. But
who was the driver?
My friend Adam.
Was that planned?
He's an angel. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. My sweet Jen would have she would not have put her foot down, but she would not have been comfortable with me doing that all night on the open roads.
Fair.
She felt much more comfortable when she found out Adam, who has been in our life for 25 years. She was like, oh, Adam's going to fall. Okay, you're fine. Go be a silly goose. Do your silly little thing and report back.
Silly goose.
Yeah.
That is comforting to have somebody out there.
It was totally a game changer. Yeah.
What a great term.
Yeah. What?
You go be a silly goose.
Silly goose.
It's funny saying that to an adult. You know, you could say that to a 3-year-old.
Right, kid. You say it to your kids, but then you raise kids and you still say these things to each other.
I love it.
Here's what I'll say. Your words echoed through my head, Ted.
Go on.
Because when you are as insecure as a human as I am, you are motivated by these things. And so... You said to me before I planned the ride, something along the lines of, on the pod, why do this? Why don't you just ride 100 miles and stay the night, credit card camp it, and then ride the next day? Mm-hmm. And I look at Laura, and Laura said, you can do this. You got this. You can make this happen. And you did not tell me I couldn't do it, to be clear. You just were being really encouraging. But I just funneled that through my insecurity funnel, and I went, Ted's telling me he doesn't think I can do it.
No.
And so I'm on it. I'm going to do it. And I'm going to prove it. And you know what? Laura thinks I can do it. So I had like the double insecurity thing working for me, obviously.
Unintentional.
No, you didn't say that at all. It's all my insecurity, but it was fuel for me. So anyway.
Mine was an invitation for that other kind of adventure, because a overnight credit card camp is its own adventure.
Absolutely.
And I was thinking, oh, okay, logistically, this seems to make more sense in my mind to do that. But
right. But I was a little afraid I couldn't do it. And so I just contorted all of your words, which I'm really good at doing. Ask Jen. We've been married 25 years. I contorted all the words to have them mean whatever I wanted, and went for it. So, it was really, really fun.
Remind the listener in one sentence what you did.
So I left from my house in Shingle Springs, which is 40 miles east of Sacramento, and rode from there 210 miles north to Redding, California.
Beginning at what time?
I left at 4:30 in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And then rode all night. Got there like 4:15 a.m. the next day. So I...
Your route basically looks like an L. You sort of go due west and then due north.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, it's pretty straight.
Yeah.
But yeah, early on, you do obviously have to go a little bit west to get Sacramento, but...
Largely just north?
Yeah, it's largely kind of due north.
Short-tailed L.
Yeah, pretty much due north, 210 miles.
Screaming average speed.
Yeah, I had a really nice tailwind.
You were moving, man.
Listeners will go on this drop and see I had a really nice tailwind the whole time. It was like really lucky. I got really, because usually that wind comes out of the
wind. Yeah, you're checking in on your stories. You're like, here I am 5 hours in and done 100 miles. I'm like, dude.
Yeah, it went.
Moving.
It went way better than I thought it would, honestly. I really thought I would average 15 miles an hour. And I thought, if I could average 15 miles an hour with a couple of stops in there, I'll be really happy. But I ended up averaging just under 18.
Did you have a low throughout the night?
So, yeah, I really thought that the first 100 miles would tick off quick. And that I told myself the first, you know, you can't finish this ride in the first 100 miles, but you can end this ride in the first 100 miles. So that's what I kept telling myself. Yep. Just get through the first 100, stay on top of nutrition, stay hydrated. I'm really bad at hydration. I'm a bit of a camel. So stay up on hydration. You can't afford to get behind. You know, just the first 100 miles to come off, right? And then I really thought the last 50 would go pretty fast because I'd be really close to my childhood home. I know all these roads. I've ridden them so many. So I thought the last 50 miles will tick off quick. I really thought those middle miles from 100 to 150 would be the dark zone, and they were. That's where it got hard. And I found I had to switch from music to a podcast. Mm-hmm. And that kind of reignited my brain. If you look at the Strava map, there was a ton of gravel. None of that was on the map.
Oh, wow.
None of that was routed. It was all asphalt and pavement. Yeah. And even my friend Adam, who is a savant with maps, went through everything on a satellite view, and it was all paved on the satellite views. And it's all, I mean, there was probably 45 miles of gravel. And I wasn't on a gravel bike. I was on my road rig. And so that actually ended up being really fun because it broke it up and it helped so much kind of change the focus and, you know, some of the monotony of just being on these straight roads.
Yeah.
And it even changed the tempo and pace of, like, you would hit the gravel and go, okay, well, I'm going to go slow here no matter what, because I don't want to flat. So I may as well just back it off even more, eat in your galant, have fun. Don't get a flat. Don't crash. So it was super fun. It went really, really well. No mechanicals. No flats.
Nutrition went down relatively well?
Nutrition, I hit a really bad spot at 80 miles. So I'd be interested in you guys post-gaming that. I think what happened was I think I over-caloried in the first 80 miles. Mm-hmm. And as I went back and looked at some of the math, I think that's what happened, because then I backed off the solid calories and went back to just liquids for about 2 hours, and then my GI distress kind of got better at about, mile 120, 130-ish.
How was your hydration? Because, you know, like, sometimes not intuitive, but dehydration is a leading factor of fatigue before even caloric deficit.
Yeah, and I think
I was riding through the night and not sleeping.
Is it really?
Yeah, it's a high cause of fatigue.
Oh, cause of fatigue. I was like, fine, dehydration riding through the night? I didn't know that. It's, you dehydrate faster in the middle of the night? Oh. This is fascinating. How funny. So I'm so bad at hydration.
Yeah.
I'm better at eating than I am hydrating. I'm a bit of a camel. And I mean, we rode today for an hour, and I know it was easy for you, but it was a tempo ride for me, and I didn't drink any water. And I finished the ride and went, oh, geez, I didn't drink. So I'm just bad at that. So I was really on top of it because I knew that I couldn't afford to get behind. So I was really solidly doing a bottle an hour. One bottle every single hour. And I had to stop and pee a couple times, which was really encouraging to me when I stopped to switch out lights once. I thought, oh, listener probably doesn't care to hear that, but I really had to pee. And I thought, oh, this is a great sign. Okay, good. Mm-hmm. So that was good. Your tips before that were super helpful. And the savory snacks were key because I did get a little bit sick of sweets. So 12 hours of sweet stuff.
Yeah, like you just get sweet fatigue.
Yeah. Yeah, it went well. So
do you have any projects on the horizon? Anything tickle your interest right now?
You know, it's funny. My friend Adam asked me that on the drive home too. And I thought, I just want to revel in this one for a while. Yeah. So I'm still kind of on a little bit of cloud nine that it went so well that I'm not thinking that way. I mean, obviously Saturday we're going to do Levi's and I've got some gravel races coming up, but nothing through the night, but I think I will do something like that again. It was cool.
It is an adventure. Yeah. Just to think, not think outside the box per se, but to you have a different perspective of what you're capable of doing. You can ride 200 miles. You can do overnights. I mean, like I was saying with the credit card camping, like, oh, that opens up a new set of possibilities. And I'm not saying that for the sake of creating expenses, but like the bike is not a 3-hour machine.
Yeah.
There's so many cool things.
I did not know I could do 200 miles. I really didn't. I mean, I know that sounds like you guys are studs and 200 miles, you guys do that multiple times a year, but I had never ridden 200 miles. I didn't know what my body would do. I didn't know if I would go to a dark emotional place of any of that. And so I think sometimes setting that goal that's so outside what seems possible actually creates its own energy. And it became a wave that kind of carried me throughout the night. And then when I'm looking down and going, I'm way ahead of schedule and I'm feeling really good.
Yeah.
And my numbers are good. Like I was obeying, I knew what power I needed to be putting out and I wasn't getting over eager. And so that became its own wave of like, I'm executing the plan correctly and I'm way ahead of schedule.
That's very energizing.
Gosh, this is so energizing. Yeah. I just want to keep rolling. And so at one point I had told Adam that, you know, at the 150 mile mark stop, I think I'm going to want to stop and lay down. And I may even take like a quick 10 minute nap. I'm like famous for my 10 minute naps. And I got there and I was like, no, dude, just give me bottles. Like, keep me fueled. And then we got to the 170 mark, which was another planned stop. And I was looking and I told him, hey, I think I can beat 12 hours. Which was never in my head. Like, I thought it would be 15 hours was sort of what we planned for. And I was like, I think I can beat 12 hours. I'm not stopping at 170. I'm just going to go to 200. And he's like, all right, chief, do your thing. Don't forget to drink. And so I got, you know, I had plenty of water. And then I put my head down and then broke all the rules. And, like, started putting in 250 watts.
And thought, perfect time to do that.
Right, that's what I thought. I'm like, it's the last 20 miles.
Yeah.
I'm just going to put my head down and, you know.
Get her done.
I started cramping 2 miles short of the finish. And I'm like, this is perfect.
Perfect.
Absolutely perfect. And rolled down a little hill and finished and rode to my dad's house and sat on the front patio with Adam. It's 4:15 in the morning and sat down and I just the biggest grin on my face. And then tried to lay down in bed, took a shower, right?
Too energized.
No chance. I just laid there. My body just vibrated for hours. Like everything twitching and moving and my arms were twitching. I'm like, what am I doing? I may as well just get up. And
you literally not sleep that night then?
No,
or did you take a cat nap later in the day?
I took a little cat nap then, like 40 minutes, and then I woke up. And then I took a little cat nap at like 4 in the afternoon.
I mean, I feel like that's how it goes if you're comparing like pre-race versus post-race. I feel like post-race sleep is worse than pre-race sleep.
Yeah.
It takes your body a long time to come down from the adrenaline, I don't know, it goes into like a different mode.
Yeah.
It's hard to sleep. All that caffeine you've ingested, it's just like not ready to turn it off.
And I think even just like pure calories, right? You just have all those.
Everything's on overdrive.
All those calories you're trying to digest and your body's going, wait, are we done or not done? What are you doing, buddy? Like, so.
I get that feeling too where your legs just spontaneously, muscles just twitch by themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, and it wasn't even a cramp. It felt like vibration.
Yeah.
Like it was just. Blah, 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 blah.
I've had that same sensation.
Oh my goodness. That was the first time I had had any of that. So thanks for all your tips and your help, guys. I wouldn't have tried it without you guys hearing about your 200 mile rides. And so I wouldn't have even thought to try it.
Well, let me interject. You did say multiple 200 mile rides per year. I'm like, man, I don't think I do more than one. I hope I don't do
that. I don't either. I don't think I did one 200 mile ride last year.
We're flattered. Thank you for thinking that we do.
Well, Gravel Locos is what? 150?
160.
160.
Anyway, we do ride long distances.
Yeah.
Preferably 200 miles or fewer.
Yeah, and by the way, enough about me. Let's talk about you. How do you feel about me?
I feel great about you. I'm thrilled. I'm glad that you read through my...
I also prompted with those questions.
I had no doubt.
Tell me how wonderful my workout was, coach. Yeah. He doesn't, but...
Yeah.
I try to tell you.
I hope our listeners will go try something hard, because I would never have tried it if you guys hadn't encouraged it. And I didn't know I could do it. And so how many other people out there don't know they can do something?
Exactly.
You just gotta go try it.
We're proud of you.
And the wave takes you. So.
Good work.
Thanks, friends.
Let's graduate on to Q&A, of which we have a whole handful of questions, beginning with... I picked these because they are geography appropriate. The question is, the Healdsburg-Napa wine country region. It sounds like all three of you have done quite a bit of riding there. What is your favorite ride experience that you have done?
Well, first let's differentiate because...
Correct. These are slightly Healdsburg different zones.
Healdsburg is wine country, as is Napa, but they're divided by a small mountain range, if I'm not mistaken. And I consider them to... I would describe the riding differently in Napa than I would describe it from Healdsburg. Would anyone disagree with me on that?
No. Yeah, definitely different.
Both have their, like, perks, and but I think we've spent far more... Well, yeah, we've spent more time in the Healdsburg area. Sonoma County.
Let's generalize it into the overall wine country region. You are correct in saying they are different zones. Sonoma is different than Napa. Counties, towns. So let's just talk wine country. What's your favorite ride experience in wine country?
Well, before I say my favorite ride experience, I would like to just describe a little bit why this is such a special region. And I think it's, I mean...
Is it because you met me here?
It's not.
Oh.
That is one positive, of course. But I think... I love riding here because there is such diversity in terrain. So you want a day of maybe, I have a lot of friends who come up and ride a TT bike or they're training for a triathlon. There's great terrain to ride a TT bike or to have just kind of gentle rolling hills. And you can be, if it's a chilly day, you can be out exposed in the sunshine. If it's a really hot day, you can find those same kind of roads in the redwoods with the in the shade and really feel a lot cooler. You can ride out to the coast if you really want to cool it down. And then you can go up some of the most stunning, endless climbs and descents that are really truly one of a kind with very little traffic anywhere you want. Just, you know, in any direction, you can easily have a 10,000 foot climbing day. So I think those are some of the things. Obviously, the weather all year round is quite temperate and often sunny. And that along with like the food and wine scene and a little bit slower pace of life as compared to, you know, the 1 hour away or 1.5 hour away San Francisco is, you know, makes it just like a destination for anyone wanting to kind of feel like they're on vacation. So
accurate. And we have spent a lot of time up here. In fact, this is how we met Stu, was on our Mill District Adventures, which is something that we juggled for the better part of 6 years, coming out here twice a year for a couple weeks or a couple months at a time. So yeah, it's really nice to be back in this area, a home away from home. Anyway, let's get down to the brass tacks. So, favorite riding in wine country? Favorite ride experience is the specific question. So riff off that as you may. And I'll actually follow it up with what is the wildest ride experience and or what is the worst ride experience? And given that those are three questions that we are three different people, we could do upwards of 9 answers here. So maybe we consolidate it. Is there something that really stands out as great?
Yeah, I have one that it's almost it's a difficult question because we've had so many memorable rides here, but
it's when we met.
One that comes to mind is actually during the pandemic when Miguel decided to host a kind of like very space limited, I think participant limited. It was like 50 max, max 50 people or something.
Hopper. Do you remember those days? Mid-pandemic, when it's like, well, there's only going to be 50 of us, so it's legit.
Yeah.
Like, how ridiculous. I'm so glad we don't live in those. But you thought it was totally normal at the time. Sorry. That was a...
We were all doing our best, right?
With our 49 other friends.
Well, and he put together, you know, together a route that was not a traditional hopper route. Let me just go back forth. Sorry. And that was the geysers, like we've talked about, which is a part of the race this weekend. And then from Geysers, we went and raced at Pine Flat. And so it was segment timed. So it was the segment from the bottom of Geysers to the top, and then the segment of Pine Flat to the top. So both were incredibly, I mean, it was a climber's race. But that aside, we were kind of also there just to, you know, it was made so that you just ride with your friends. And this is one of those days that I was riding with one of my best friends, Jess Sarah, who was a former pro road cyclist. And we always talk about how we wish we could have had the opportunity to ride together or race together. We feel like we would have been a really good team. And it was one of those days where we decided to take these segments together, and we just, you know, we just pushed each other to our limit. And I just remember finishing, and it was like, didn't really matter how we performed. It was more that that's just such a unique feeling to be able to, along with someone else, push yourself really deep. And then just like, I don't know, have this immense feeling of gratitude for getting to do it with somebody that you enjoy so much and the sport that you enjoy so much. And I've had a lot of those moments with Jess Sarah. But that day in the sunshine, it was just like, I don't know, we were just on cloud nine. So that's the day that comes to mind. Two amazing climbs that we do as often as we get the chance to do, and getting to kind of put the hammer down together. And we have a lot of photos from that day of us just like each one like switching off, like I'm on her wheel, she's on my wheel, and just kind of pace lining together and just being a good team.
That's awesome. Speaking of awesome, the benefits of in-person live podcasting is, I don't know if you can hear the chainsaw in the background.
I was wondering when somebody was going to say something.
They're doing a little bit of logging nearby. It is not on the property on which we stand, so we can't tell him to leave. And even if we could, he has a chainsaw, so I wasn't going to ask him to stop. He's probably a podcast listener. Anyway, John, good luck editing that out. Thank you for your hard work. Stu, do you have any standout, yeah, for better or worse, riding here?
I think anybody who comes to this area, honestly, like within 50 miles of this area, Cullman Valley Road is the go-to. Like, that might be my favorite road to ride on earth. And partly because it's just stunning for those who are unaware. I mean, come out to Occidental and just search Cullman Valley Road and look at the heat maps, and it won't be hard to find a ride over it. And there's a number of ways over it, depending on if you're on a road or a gravel bike. But you climb, depending on your direction. I usually start from Occidental and climb over, and you drop into the ocean. And I've had some of my most powerful and amazing experiences, even like a pretty powerful spiritual experience once, riding over it. Because you climb up Cullman Valley and it's like wooded, and you go by like this old abandoned schoolhouse, and you just feel like you're in another world, like from, you know, 100 years ago. And I've not ridden in Europe like you guys, but it feels to me like Europe. Like, it's what I imagine when I think about climbing some alpine climb in Europe. But so don't shatter my glass if you're like, you know, no, you goofball. You climb over it, and then you get up to the top, and it sort of levels out and does a little false flat, and then there's cows everywhere, just in the road. And then you ride along this kind of false flat for, I don't know, what is it, like maybe a mile or two is all.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you get this big reveal, and you can obviously see the ocean due west. You can see all the way down the San Rafael Valley to the south. You can look back and see back to the redwoods behind you to the east. It's just, Cullman Valley Road is kind of, it's everything. And you then descend the backside of the ocean, and I've done a number of rides where you dip your tire in the ocean and then turn around and ride right back over the same way. And you don't have to. You can do all kinds of ways, but Cullman Valley, like, if I had to pick one ride, that's the one around here. Some cool experiences.
Can't argue that one.
Yeah.
King Ridge has a lot of those elements too, though.
Yes, King Ridge is amazing.
And combine that with Myers Grade, and you might tip the scale.
Really?
For me, on choosing that route over Cullman Valley.
I don't know if I've ever done Myers Grade.
Oh, it's, well, if you come off of King Ridge, the only way to get back to town towards is if you're coming towards the coast and okay. going south is going down Myers Grade, which okay. is the big okay. sweeping.
Oh, this is the one where you feel like you're on like the ridge and you can kind of see both sides and okay.
Yeah, yeah. Big sweeping descent with massive views of the ocean, and it's pretty magical as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are some good ones.
What about you, Ted? Mm. Okay, now it's time to say that it was a ride when you where you met me.
It was definitely not that, although there were really cool events.
Oh, thanks.
No, in making this video to go full circle on the podcast, I've been able to think of all of the times that I've spent in Occidental. Occidental in particular, and then Sonoma, the greater Sonoma area. And yeah, it's really cool to think of the team training camps that I've done from Santa Rosa, and you know, riding out here to Occidental was always a hoot. And doing my first ever grasshoppers, hit a lot of the, you know, this is Stu and I were talking about it today. It's like the original grasshoppers were they're entirely paved. I mean, like there aren't a lot of gravel roads here, and so that's a cool aspect of this area when you think about it. And it also goes full circle and like, is this Levi's Fondo a gravel event or a paved event? I mean, they're paved, but they're just super adventure rides. In particular, one that does stand out is racing here in Tour California. I think we started in Santa Rosa and then went up. I always can't think of it. What's the one that's not King Ridge?
Fort Ross.
And we raced up Fort Ross, and Ben King was on Radio Shack and I was on Liquid Gas, and the two of us just took turns telling people on a road that's very European. It's no more than 10 feet wide. Maybe it's 12 feet wide. And inevitably everybody is strung out. So you know that you're just absolutely giving it, just like smoking the riders behind you. And then we get up to the top, you turn left. Like you said, you descend Myers Grade, which is just, it's like riding a glass elevator shaft down. And, you know, you're going, you could hit 50 miles an hour, but you also don't want to because there's some off camber corners that come up really quickly. And yeah, you do that at 50 miles per hour, 80K, and you're in trouble. And then you sneak down, and it's cool that you guys were talking about the rides that you've done, because then you go down and down along the coast, go left, go up Coleman, which is a beast. And we've raced up that a handful of times in Tour California, and often that's the end of my day and I've been working and it's like, okay, time to pull the ripcord. But then I made it over that climbed that day, and we raced into Santa Rosa, and Peter got second. He did not win that stage.
Well, there you go, listener. That's the way to do it. If you really want one of the best days in the entire world, either King Ridge or Fort Ross will get you to the same place. King Ridge will be a little bit longer. Both spectacular. Up to the ridge there, down Myers Grade, and then up Coleman Valley, and you have just hit each of our spots.
Done a true Sonoma County Classic.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Now, the question specifically is, does Ted still follow road racing? If yes, what is he enjoying? And let's generalize it. Are we watching bike races? I think it is appropriate to talk about this now because the classics have just wrapped up, and we've talked about, I mean, I think some of the standout things of the classics are injuries, which we've talked about, to go back to the Levi's conversation, like what Wout Van Aert did. You know, he sort of wrecked himself. And then Tour of the Basque Country is going on, which is not a classic, but answers the question of what am I watching? I watch everything. We live in, I call it the golden age of cycling media. It's amazing what we can consume. That race, Tour of the Basque Country, is characteristic of taking out Remco Evenepoel and Vingegaard. I mean, taking out the world's best cyclists. Meanwhile, you got this other standout cyclist named Matthew Vanderpoel, who's winning everything in sight by a country mile. No different than Tadej Pogacar, who's winning by, let's go on an 80K breakaway. I'm watching everything. I love watching everything. I think I would, I am enjoying watching these sort of superhuman performances, the Tadej's, the Remco's, the Wout's, the Matthew Vanderpoel's, because it's reminiscent to me of what Sagan was doing. People are like, oh, that's inhuman. And of course you're going to, you know, you can scratch your head and say, is this legit? And it wasn't until I was racing with him, like, oh my gosh, you are just talent on another level.
Yeah.
And I think that's what, especially the generation, he showed the Wouts and the Vanderpoels, hey, you can do everything. You can sprint, you can climb, you can time trial. Like, why not do it all? And that, like, it just changes the mental mindset of a 10-year-old training. And I know, you know, the same story goes with Tade. Like, he's been training like a world tour cyclist since the time he was in his early teens. Conversely, it's also kind of boring, you know?
The women, well, are we talking like Roubaix? Because the women's race was so much more interesting than the men's.
I'd agree. I would agree to that.
I was wondering if you watched the women's race.
Of course I did.
Okay.
That was awesome. I was thrilled that they were on different days.
Yeah.
Also, then you
could dedicate the day to watching the women's race.
I do not watch racing as much as Ted, but I discovered while not on mom duty on my California getaway that when I have the time, I love watching bike racing. And often Ted is watching it on his phone, and so it's not like on some big screen, and I just don't ever log on to actually watch it. But I did this weekend, both races, and I thought the men's race it was really kind of over before it was over.
That's where it's boring. It's so dynamic until something happens, and then you basically just have your eyes on those standout riders. Like, is he actually suffering? Is he getting dropped? Oh, yeah. Nope, he's going on a 50-mile breakaway. And I'm glad, you know, yes, you don't sit down and watch bike races, and I rarely sit down and watch bike races. Like, they're going on in the background with this awesome modern media of our telephones. You do also consume a whole bunch of triathlon. Like, you like maintaining what's up going on in the big triathlons and the big marathons.
Yeah, and that brings up a good point. I find it easier to access the media than I most of the time, if the race is not on, you know, if it's on some sort of, what are the subscriptions?
Subscription services.
Yeah, then I don't access it. Triathlon is not that way. There's not subscription needed to watch it. So if there's an Ironman on, if there's a PTO race, professional triathlon organization broadcasts everything, and they broadcast it over a selection of mediums where you can watch it free streaming on YouTube. I mean, and so the accessibility is not the barrier. And I just,
who's making money then? Mr. YouTube.
Hey, it's an interesting point, is it not?
No, it's a great point. I'm not kidding. Yeah. I mean, it goes back to the question we posed a podcast or two ago. And I'm like, I don't want to watch gravel racing. Turns out I was in the minority.
You got roasted online for that.
Yeah, thank you, listeners,
agree with the point.
For all your feedback.
For your emails and for your Instagram messages. I mean, I had people commenting on my Strava rides.
Ted's wrong.
Disconnected, going, by the way, Laura's right, Ted's wrong. I'm like...
Fair. It is good to know that the demand is there.
Laura's currently entertaining offers from multiple races to head up their media departments. So please send yours.
Stu, are you watching bike races?
Yeah. And, you know, I was really quiet when you guys talked about the boredom of Paris-Roubaix.
Yeah.
Because I watch them and I love them.
I
usually watch the first 20 minutes of Paris-Roubaix to get the pre-race interviews and to see some of the bike tech, because I think that's super fun. All the freak machine bikes.
62 tooth one bikes.
What?
And like not a guy. Like
whole team.
A bunch of guys. So I mean that part I enjoy. And then usually I fast forward to like the final hour. Right.
Do you watch the opening hour? That's what I love about modern.
Yeah.
Like, where all the... Because it used to be you'd log into the NBC, whatever it was, and you're like, let's watch the final 40 miles. It's like, dude, you missed the first 2 hours of action.
Yeah.
So you do watch that.
Yeah, but this Paris-Roubaix, I watched every single minute, and I couldn't turn it off. I found it so riveting.
Yeah.
And I think mostly...
Both? Women's?
I did not watch the full women's race.
I don't think they live streamed the beginning of the women's race.
Well, both were on Peacock, and that's how I watched it, on Peacock. But I had been traveling that week, and so I came back and watched the men's race first. And I'm blanking the name of the gentleman for DSM, who he's won Paris-Roubaix.
Dave McCall.
I found that to be the most riveting part of the day. Like, I could not... And the young Kiwi... kid, he was super interesting too to watch, and he just put his head down and like crashed and flatted and just kept.
That's his name.
Going. Yeah, he's really
good. Races for FDJ, anyway.
Exactly. Yep. But I found Degen Kolb to be fascinating to watch that day because he had mechanicals like he seems to always have, and he had issues, and yet he always chased back on and found himself back in the front group. Mm-hmm. You had the one Ineos young kid,
Carling.
Yeah, he was like holding on to the side of the car, and it's. Have you ever seen that mid race where they're like, "Take your number off, you're done."
I think that's a new aspect. I think it has to do with modern media. I think it's more televised, there's more cameras. Yeah, yeah.
So they have no choice once they've seen it.
Yeah, it's like, hey, it was on TV.
It was funny because they're like, wow, he is back awfully quick. And he's like, ugh. Well, I guess we know why he's back.
Well, they hit back, you know, and it's like, and the car is like, accelerating.
He's like, I have a 62 tooth drive.
Leave me alone.
I did it on my own.
So I found Perry Baby riveting this year, and I just, I couldn't take my eyes off it. And it was obviously Vanderpool was unbelievable.
Another level.
But I found some of the other guys to be even more interesting. Just the chase.
Yeah, it was fun to watch the whole way through. It's not purely boring once he's gone, because then the race for second is like, what do you call it? The guy in UAE. It was the race among mortals, yeah. Right? I mean, like, okay, how's the rest of the podium going to shake out?
Right, and you got a couple, like, top-notch sprinters in there, mm-hmm. that you got to try and get these guys to take a turn, because they're just going to out-sprint us in the velodrome.
And then team dynamics come into play, because, yeah, you have Philipson, whose teammate is up there. I can't pull. My teammate's 3 minutes up the road alone, but I'm also the best sprinter in the race. Yeah. Why don't you guys take me to the line?
Yeah. But
you're damned if you do, and you're damned if you don't. That's what... it's such an entertaining race.
I was fascinated also by Mads Pedersen's just poise.
Yep.
Like, how do you just put your head down and continue to just absolutely pound your brains in, mm-hmm. when you know you're dragging the best sprinter in the world to the line, and you know Vanderpool is gone, mm-hmm. and somehow, I mean, he's not throwing his arms around, he's not screaming and yelling, he just puts his head down and goes. And I'm like, that there's a character piece there that it goes beyond cycling. Like,
you ever listen to his interviews?
No.
They're rare, because he's a pretty short-worded individual, but he'll say it as it is. And it's almost the same way he races a bike. Yeah. Just be like, well, this is how it was. This is how it was the bike race. And no different. Like, he recognizes the place he's in the bike race. Throwing your arm in the air isn't going to change anything.
Right.
Showing you're frustrated is only going to show a weakness. And he's such a talent, and he's been on my radar because we share the same agent. And like, when he won the world championships, everyone's like, that was a fluke. That was a weird fluke, but that's
he's like
fluke.
21, right?
Yeah, 21-year-old kid in the breakaway all day, wins in some abysmal weather. He doesn't win frequently, but he wins massively.
Yeah.
And it's cool because now he's hitting his stride. He's in, late 20s probably. And so he's winning with a bit more regularity. And he shows up to classics, and he's a standout 5-star favorite.
Yeah.
It's so cool to see people like, oh, Mads is pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, and I'm not saying I discovered him, because our agency discovered him, but it's cool to see how flipping talented he is.
I'd be so interested to hear your thoughts, both of you, on the Theo Jorgensen in the Flanders climb.
Yeah.
Like that. Have you ever seen anything like that before?
No, frankly. I mean, outside of watching like somebody like Tade. You know, Tadej Pogačar wins Flanders last year, which is, it's weird because he's a GC general classification week-long Grand Tour rider, and Flanders is this gnarly 250K one-day classic. And I think it's beginning, we're in this cool age of diversity. It goes back to, you know, people being really multi-talented across the board and being standout athletes. And so can you climb? Can you be a classics rider? Can you be a sprinter? It's cool, especially this year, in that he has changed teams. He no longer has to source all his own, you know, hyper age of nutrition or aerodynamics. Like his team, Jumbo, Lisa Bike, Visma, whatever they're called these days, they're so in tune with those things, and you just see him excel. And I think I had him on my podcast earlier this year, and it was really cool to see him recognize the role that he's coming into. Like, he has the role that Wout had at the tour when Jonas first won the tour. He's basically a road captain, and his job is to navigate Jonas Vingegaard, 2-time Tour de France champion. The point being, he's so talented across the board. He just won Paris-Nice a week or so before, 2 weeks, 3 weeks before. And to watch him go toe-to-toe with the pure classics guys and just see his, like, that's where he stands out as a climber. And he's a smooth climber on these really short, punchy climbs. And his pedal stroke is fluid and so efficient.
Do you think there still is that differentiation as much as there was in your kind of era, if you want to call it, of racing, of, like, being a pure classics rider?
Yeah, I think especially my era, it was specialized.
No, I mean like now. Yeah.
Whereas now, I think all riders in the world tour. Okay, there are standout guys who are. If you're an extraordinary sprinter, you're only going to be a good sprinter. If you're, like Philip Sand is an extraordinary sprinter. People will discount any sort of world tour sprinter. Mark Cavendish. Mark Cavendish turns out goes up a hill faster than any mere mortal. Mm-hmm. But when you are hyper specialized like that, then sure, that is what you do exclusively, and that's your sole job. My point is, I feel like now you need to be more diversified because, and I think it goes to like UCI points. There's so many weird things. I think UCI points go really deep. So even if you are a sprinter and you're in a climbing stage, like, yeah, you want to finish top 80 to accrue a couple points for your team. Whereas, yeah, in my day, I think it was very specialized and that was it. Unless you were a domestique. Mm-hmm. That's where I really basked in my role because I did everything perfectly adequately. And so I got to race week-long races and a couple grand tours and sprints and the classics and the Paris-Nice, Tour of California, and everything in between.
Well, I think what Matteo Jorgensen did there this spring was incredible. And I think it shouldn't...
It's awesome.
It should be pointed out that he didn't win any races before going on King of the Ride.
I agree.
So
you noticed that?
I noticed it. I think our listeners noticed it. So,
I think you won Tour of Oman last year.
To all of you young pros who want to win races, come on, Ted's podcast.
There are places to go.
It really is a great episode because he just, he's so down to earth. Mm-hmm. He's just like this normal human being. But
yeah, goes alpine touring. He's a skier in the winter. He decks out his van and then he goes, time to go check in at the office and go pay your dues for the next 10 months. It's a hard life, but he seems like he's this generation really is basking in it, it seems. Especially when you're extraordinarily talented, right? But
my biggest shout out goes to, I think you pronounce her name, Ellen Van Dyke.
That sounds right. Yep.
6 months postpartum. Insane. Holding her own at the front of Roubaix.
That's bananas. Impressive. I knew that she had recently had it.
Yeah, six months ago. 6 months. She came back to racing. Huh. Just
did she have a Mack ride on her bike?
A Mack ride.
Bring the kid. Oh, really? That's nuts.
Yeah.
6 months.
It's pretty impressive.
Should we mansplain what it's like to ride a bike postpartum? I've watched my wife have four babies, so should I explain this to you, Laura?
The guilt factor? Should I be riding right now?
Oh my goodness.
Amazing. Yeah.
Well, we gritted through it. Or at least Hayden did. He put his head down and went back to sleep.
Yeah, we're doing this during nap time, and the kids really are...
Just awesome.
This was stellar. Well, I think we should enjoy the sunshine today, enjoy the sunshine tomorrow, and keep our fingers crossed that the sun pokes its head out from behind the eclipse of the rainstorm on Saturday.
Are you checking it now? Are you checking the updated weather for
Saturday? Yeah, I am. But I'm also thinking,
advantage of no good weather.
I mean, you especially, Ted, you have been training in the worst weather all year long. If there's anyone that is prepared to ride in cold, wet weather, I say it's you.
That's kind. Well, with any luck, it'll snow, and then I'll be in my element.
Then you'll really be in your element.
Right. Yeah, the worse weather, the better.
All right. Listener, thank you. We appreciate you. If you have questions, we encourage you to send them in. Send them to...
GravelKingsPodcast@gmail.com.
Yes, please. Send them on over.
Thank you to everyone who has. It's really fun to get your messages, to get your questions, to understand what you're interested in. And by all means, don't hesitate to inundate our inbox, because if we have a running kind of list developing, and if we don't get to your message or your question, we most likely eventually will. So,
yeah. And I'll add to that. We did just get stickers. I haven't even given them to you guys yet. I have stickers. So listener, if you even just send us a question in, and add your mailing address, I will mail you a sticker.
Wow. What are you going to do when you get inundated?
Just like that.
By many individual email requests.
We'll send them off. No problem.
I love it.
I have a teenager at home. Aaron, I need you to address some envelopes. I made a promise online.
Awesome. All right. Until the next time.
All right.
Catch you later.
Bye.
Bye.